That'll give the latecomers a chance to come. So, we were studying this equation. We let u equals gamma to the minus a half w, and we got to this equation with q Laplace gamma to the 1/2 over gamma to the 1/2. And then we spent a fair bit of time constructing solutions psi. So let's say for q in LP of this form, we constructed solutions of minus Laplace plus q psi is 0 with e to the minus I z k psi. Minus 1 in LP tilde. And let me quickly remind you that what we did is we wrote mu e to the minus I z k psi. And we basically had mu solve this linear integral equation with mk, the operator, what was the operator? The operator was minus 1 over 4 ik d bar inverse minus d plus ik inverse d bar inverse so that's a brief sketch of what we've done. So now the question is, all right, so now we have these solutions, what do we do with them? And so for today, so motivation on how to use these solutions to solve in an inversion method. So, since the operative word is motivation, most of what I'm going to say for the next few hours is so mostly formal sketch. So, formal means we won't be filling in all the details of proofs. Doesn't mean it's wrong. And so to motivate, what we did is we had a quick, crash course on 1D inverse scattering. For Schrödinger on the real line. So we'll see how that's done. So this is okay. So since some people seemed a bit confused about the history, let me point out that this 1D theory was developed well before the discovery that it's useful for solving nonlinear equations like KdV. So the names are Gelfand, Levitan, Marchenko, Fadeev, but for rigor, the names, so this is for rigor, Deift and Trubowitz and Melin, and possibly also Marchenko. And what was the motivation? The motivation was quantum mechanics. You want to find the interactions, the potential from scattering data. And that was viewed as too hard to do in 3D. So people were talking about radial potentials and doing it on the half line. And then it turns out it's easier to first understand the whole real line and then discuss the half line, or to use methods from one problem on the other one. All right, so we assumed V for simplicity. V bounded of compact support. And I pointed out the theory goes much further than that. And I also assumed, and without bound states. And I will come back to that. Because there's something else I want to tell you. And so we can, what was the story? The story was that we had I forgot what the notation was. What do we call it? Psi plus? Phi. Phi plus. In fact, maybe it's better if I borrow Dr. Thomason's notes, if I may. All right. So psi plus of xk solution of this plus Q plus V is K squared psi plus with phi plus e to the I x k for x big, and psi minus solution of the same equation, which is e to the I x k for x over here. So say V has support somewhere here. Then out here the solutions have to be linear combinations of e to the ixk and e to the minus ixk. And we've showed that psi plus e to the minus ixk minus 1 is in the Hardy space of so IE extends to an analytic function I'll give you this back in a second. Analytic function in the upper half plane in K. So as a function of K. With appropriate, I won't stress too much, appropriate growth condition or boundedness condition, L2 boundedness. And phi minus is a minus function. Same thing with lower K complex plane. So this is C plus up here, C minus down here. And how does scattering data arise? Well, let's just look at psi plus. Right, psi plus starts out to e to the ixk here. You solve this initial value problem, ODE. Well, out here it's going to satisfy this equation where V is zero, so it'll have to be so phi plus, in fact, equals. A e to the I kx plus B e to the minus I kx for x thank you. So you can think of this as scattering data. And what we showed is A of K extends to an analytic function in C++. Now, one can show that for reasonable Q, for say V well, let's not talk about the, this is formal right now. So for reasonable potentials, A can vanish only for K imaginary, so only on this axis, where it has finitely many simple zeros. Let's call them I kappa 1, I kappa 2, I kappa n. So I kappa 1, I kappa 2, moreover, I kappa j squared, j from 1 to n, are the bound state energies of the Schrödinger operator. So this is an aside, but it's just too beautiful to ignore. So what does that mean? That means these are the numbers, i.e. lambda, such that this, let's say, V, no, V, V, F is lambda F, has an L2 solution. So an eigenvalue, lambda, is one for which there is an L2 solution F. So this is minus kappa 1 squared minus kappa 2 squared, and so forth. So the only numbers lambda, complex numbers lambda, for which there is an L2 solution, in fact, the numbers for which are precisely these minus kappa j squared. Right, 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 right. If V is positive, there are none. So, so thus, the no bound states assumption is equivalent to A zero free. So to say that there are no bound states is to say that A doesn't vanish. But now, for those of you interested in KdV, aside. Suppose V of X and T satisfies the KdV equation. So it's a nonlinear PDE in one time and one X variable. So fact A of KT is then independent of T. So the transmission coefficient, which is 1 over A, is constant, is conserved by this motion. So in particular, so are the bound state energies. So if A has zeros, so what I'm trying to say here is the following. For the purposes of the motivation in this course, dealing with the zeros of A is a technicality which I'm trying to push aside. But before I push it aside, I want to tell you how wonderful these zeros are. That's what this aside is about. So the point is the following. If you study KdV, suppose you study some Cauchy problem, where you have some initial profile at time zero, some profile V naught at time zero. And you watch it flow. Now, what's known about flow with time according to the KdV flow? What's known about KdV is that if you wait long enough, a number of solitons will separate out. With the biggest one going the fastest, and they move, I believe, to the right. And then there's some other stuff moving away and dying off to the left. Each of the solitons corresponds precisely to one of these bound state energies. And in fact, you can write down a formula for this hump if you have this energy. The size and speed of the hump is explicit, some Cauch function that involves this kappa. Okay, so now comes the punchline. You take V naught and you do this scattering on it and you find A naught. Of K, sorry. You look at the zeros of A naught in the complex plane. And that allows you to predict precisely how many solitons are in this V naught, hiding and ready to separate out, what their size is and what their speed will be. What happens if? If there's no zero, then there's no solitons and the thing will just die out. Yes, I believe so. So, okay, so the punchline was, I'm ruling out the zeros of A, but they're wonderful. Okay? So this is one of the glories of this discovery, that when V is some ugly shape here about which you cannot say anything, in fact, if you calculate the A naught for this V, its zeros will tell you precisely what this will look like in the future. How many solitons are in there? Right. Is hidden in this. That's right. That's right. Right. That's right. My pleasure. Okay, and the other part I told you about last time, that B evolves linearly. Oh, so by the way, also things like constants of motion are somehow hidden in the A, since A does not change with time. For instance, by expanding A, finding the large K asymptotics of A, you find constants of motion and so forth. But A itself is a constant of the motion. On the other hand, B evolves linearly. dB dt is, if I'm not mistaken, something like ik cubed B. So from this V naught, you can also find B naught. Then you solve a simple linear equation that gives you B at time t. A at time t is the same as the initial one. So if you can do inverse scattering, you can, quote, explicitly solve, or at least constructively solve, the Cauchy problem. You now know what V is at time t. So that's the aside on the KdV story. Back to inverse scattering. So one of the things we did is we divided by A. A tends to 1, so this is still minus 1, is still sorry, this over A, still, or also in H of C plus. And that has the advantage of being more physical, So if you now compare this with A phi minus plus B, we did this as well, phi minus of minus k. Okay, here is the linear combination of two solutions of the Schrödinger equation. It is therefore a solution of the Schrödinger equation. Let's look at what it does at minus infinity. Well, phi minus is this 4x, 4x to the left. Phi minus of minus k is that, 4x to the left. Therefore, phi plus and this function agree when x is out here. Two solutions agree out there, therefore they agree everywhere. So this implies this for every x. And this is for k real. So this is in fact going to be the basis for the starting point for the inverse problem. Okay? I'm just repeating stuff I did last time. So if we divide by No, one goes up in the upper half plane, the other in the lower half plane. So I can only say this. Well, it's a bit confusing. When V has compact support, in fact, this is. But for general V, phi plus only extends in the upper half plane, phi minus only in the lower half plane. So this relationship, and in fact, B, in general, only makes sense for K real. A extends, but B does not. But that's enough. Plus R phi minus of minus K, where R is B over A is the reflection coefficient. And 1 over A is the transmission coefficient for a reason I explained last time. So this is for K real. So, as I was saying, this has two advantages. One is that it's a little more physical, with the transmission and reflection coefficients coming out. Two is that it will allow us to reconstruct V will reconstruct V from R. So in general, that's not enough. In general, also need the bound state energies. And corresponding norming constants. Which I haven't talked about and I won't talk about. Except maybe in passing in a moment. All right. Yes, sir. Right. That's right. Exactly. That's right. If A has zero, we need to be a little more careful, as I will point out in a second. Precisely that's where this comes in. So you'll see in a moment where that happens. So now let's multiply out by this exponential. And subtract 1. So here it's r of k e to the minus I x k phi minus of x minus k. So let mu plus equal this thing on the left. Which is in H C plus, and mu minus equal phi minus e to the minus I Z X K minus 1. So the basic equation, let's call this one star, so with this notation, I haven't done anything, just rewrote a few, redefined some functions, so star becomes mu plus equals mu minus plus r of k e to the minus 2 I k x mu minus of minus k. Okay? From here. This is mu plus, this is mu minus. Oh, yakety yak. No, I don't like the minus one here, sorry. Now we make a little aside on the projection operators, P plus minus. So given a function f in this case Fk, in L2 of the real line. So by Blanchot's theorem or Fourier inversion, this is e to the I k xi f hat xi d xi. And we split that into e to the I kc into the part with Fourier components in one half line and the other part Fourier component for positive xi. So define P plus F to be e to the I k xi F hat xi d xi, and P minus F the other one. So we've written F as P plus plus P minus. We note that P plus squared. What happens if you take P plus off P plus? The Fourier transform of P plus is just the Fourier transform of F times the Heaviside function of xi, characteristic function zero infinity of xi. So P plus of that just multiplies these, and that gives you chi squared is chi. So this is equal to P plus. Same for P minus. And P plus P minus is zero. Also P plus star is P plus. It's just multiplication by a real function. So these are orthogonal projections. And what's the point? So note P plus F K real plus I K I e to the I K kr e to the minus ki xi f hat xi d xi. Since xi is positive, this exponential will be bounded if the imaginary part of k so extends to an analytic function. So p plus f extends to an analytic function for ki positive. In fact, more precisely, p plus f is the boundary value, the boundary value of a function in H of C plus in the Hardy space. Oh, this is an analytic function up here. So so if you're asking, so formally, if you take d bar of this, if you take the derivative in k, this is analytic in k, so it should give you zero. So if you're asking how do you prove that, you may want to prove it, for instance, using, what's it called, Morera's theorem. So you integrate along a closed curve this function, use Fubini on this, then you're being integrating this, which gives you zero, because it's an analytic function of k. Right. Then you would have a growing exponential here. Number one, the integral might not exist. Okay. Second of all, when I said Fubini, I had in mind, right, that this integral with the decaying exponential is absolutely integrable. Whatever. Or you can, or by dominated convergence, you can move the d bar inside. And it does not work for the when you have a growing exponential. So intuitively, just assume that this is somehow a convergent series of analytic functions. All right. So what has this done? This has allowed us to take an arbitrary function of L2 on the real line and split it into one function, in fact, in a unique way, into a function which is analytic in the, in fact, Hardy in the upper half plane, and one which is Hardy in the lower half plane. Or if you wish more precisely, extends one which extends to a Hardy function in the upper half plane, extends to one in the lower half plane. Okay, so let's take a break and then we'll finish this 1D business off. Well, for instance, you can what? So it has to be an entire function, which is L2 on the real line. And I mean, let's see, if F is equal to F1 plus F2, where F1 is in H plus, and F2 is in HC minus, right? I can just hit it with P plus. So P plus of a plus function is itself. P plus of a minus function is zero. So F1 has to, so because of these two relations, F1 has to be P plus F. It's bounded, it's not in L2, and when you extend sine analytically, it grows exponentially, my friend. It becomes. So try an exercise that if let's say if F is analytic, so entire, and the integral of F of k plus kr plus iki dkr sup over ki is finite, this should imply F0. So this, right, this is true for ki positive, it's true if you're in H plus, for ki negative, it's true if you're in H minus. So if you're in both, this is true the whole plane. All right, so what I wanted to do is actually give you the expression of P plus P minus as integral kernels, integral operators. So so P plus F hat is Heaviside function of Xi F hat. So P plus F is the inverse Fourier transform of that. So it's the inverse Fourier transform of this convolved with F. Right? Products goes into convolution. So what's the inverse Fourier transform of this? So that's 1 over 2 pi integral e to the I k c times characteristic function of 0 infinity and by right, so the question is, how does one define this? This is the Fourier transform of 1, 1 on a half. Right, that's not an integrable function, it's not an L2 function, so you have to think of it as a distribution. And I won't go much into this, but you can think of this. So this is a whatever Abel way of putting a writing it. There's a limit of things which do make sense. So as epsilon goes to zero, this disappears. So you can think of that as the limit. That's one way of understanding this Fourier transform. And now that's an integral that we can do. So that's e to the I k minus epsilon xi d xi. So this is 1 over I k minus epsilon. Again, I'm proceeding semi-formally here, but can make sense out of these things. I mean, you can, so this is equal to minus the value when xi is zero. Let's factor out the I here. So this is 1 over 2 pi I limit as epsilon goes down to 0 of 1 over k plus I epsilon. So this is written k plus I zero. Well, it's plus I zero, the other one is minus I zero. I'm giving it to you yes, it's a tempered distribution. If you want to understand these things rigorously, you go into the Gelfand generalized functions, volume 1. Anyway, so my claim is this is a tempered distribution. And its Fourier transform is multiplication by chi 0 infinity. And so, p plus of f k is equal to minus 1 over 2 pi I k minus k prime plus I zero dk prime. And I just realized that I should have done p minus instead of p plus. So p minus has a plus here and a minus there. Okay, so again, all of this is motivation, so we don't want to get too deeply into the, too much sidetracked here. So where is our basic equation? It's disappeared. It's that one. Let me write it again here. Mu plus is mu minus plus r e minus 2i kx mu minus minus k. This is for k real. So now we subtract 1 on both sides, and we apply p minus to this equation. P minus of the is 0 because mu plus minus 1 is in H plus. And P minus of mu minus is itself since p minus projects on h minus. And so we get 0 equal mu minus minus 1 plus p minus of this function. Or mu minus minus 1 equals minus p minus of that, which is minus 1 over 2 pi I integral r k prime e minus 2 I k prime mu minus k prime over k minus k prime minus I zero. Dk prime. All right, so how do we understand what just happened? Well, we have that relationship between mu plus and mu minus, which comes essentially from the definition of the scattering data. If we combine that with what we know about mu plus and mu minus, namely that one extends analytically in the upper half plane, the other in the lower half plane, and they basically tend to 1 for large K, then we can think of this as known. Call it F. Right? Then this basically gives you a splitting of F into a plus and a minus function. Therefore, we know that the plus part is P plus of this and the minus part is P minus of that. Why do we use P minus? Because that gives us an integral equation. This is now an integral equation. Now we come back to the fact that we don't really know that F, but it is written back in terms of mu minus. And so that gives us a singular integral equation for the function, unknown function mu minus. So given R of K, you give me the scattering data. Mu minus can be found by solving the singular, because this is a singular integral, linear integral equation. So if you now take the Fourier transform of this in K, you're basically back to the so famous Gelfand-Levitan equation. So can be rewritten as the Gelfand-Levitan equation. And once you have mu minus, you can find V. So maybe I should tell you how that's done. Okay, so if you blinked, you missed it. I just did inverse scattering. So forward scattering, you know V. You calculate these solutions, and A, therefore A and B, and therefore R. Inverse scattering, you give me R. I want to find V. Well, here's an integral equation, where the only thing you need to know is R. The rest is explicit. It allows you to find mu minus. Now the question is, if you know mu minus, how do you find V? Well, it's not a trivial thing. That's why people didn't like singular integral equations, so that's why they go back to taking the Fourier transform nk, which gets you back to sort of more palatable things like characteristic function of a half line. No, I mean, it's not trivial. There's some work involved. Well, I'll check into that proof. It doesn't spring back to mind. Oh, thank you for reminding me. Now, look at P minus. This is to answer your question about what happens when there's zeros. And this is not in H minus. Okay. So, where did we use the fact that A has no zeros? We used it in saying that P minus of this is zero. If you look at P minus, when you apply it to something with poles, you will get some residues. This integral will produce residues at those poles. So that the general equation here, in addition to this, will have a finite sum coming from the poles of mu plus and their residues. Right? So the more the general Gelfand-Levitan equation has some more stuff in it. And by the way, for the fans of KdV, that stuff is again gorgeous because you can now put R equals zero. The solitons are pure soliton solutions are the ones where R is zero. You can put R equals zero, and then you get with this finite sum, you get a non-trivial equation which can be solved explicitly and gives you the formula for the n-soliton solution. But that is not our concern right now. Okay, so just briefly, how do we recover V when we know mu? Look at the large K asymptotics of mu. So mu minus equals 1 plus O of 1 over K. We already know that. Now, let's just again just play with this formally. If you formally look at the integral equation for mu minus, and you say what happens for large K, for large K, this looks like 1 over K times whatever. So this is the integral R of K prime e to the minus 2i K prime x mu minus x minus K prime dK prime. Plus O 1 over K squared. So this is for nice Q. So this is from the inverse equation, from the inverse equation. V, thank you. So the inverse equation is this. On the other hand, let's see what that asymptotic is from the forward problem. So substitute phi minus equals mu minus e to the I x k in plus v phi equals k squared phi. So what's the derivative of phi? It's mu minus prime plus I k mu. What's the double derivative? Mu minus double prime plus 2ik mu prime minus k squared. So the equation for mu is minus mu minus double prime minus 2ik mu minus prime plus k squared mu minus equals k squared mu minus. So this is 0. And I forgot the v. So this is plus v mu minus. Okay, so all I'm saying here is take the solution of Schrödinger, write it as mu minus times that exponential. This is the resulting equation for mu minus. That should be reminiscent of what happened when we tried to construct mu in 2D. We had a similar equation, which we worked on. Now, substitute mu equals 1 plus, let's call it mu infinity over k, plus higher order in here, in this. You will see the point in a second. So that will give me another formula for the 1 over k term in the expansion for large k. And by comparing the two formulae, I will have a formula for v. So if you substitute, this is 0 minus mu infinity double prime over k plus lower order. Then I have minus 2ik 0 plus mu infinity prime over k. Okay. Then I have plus v mu infinity over k plus lower order. So I will go over here, and so I have minus mu infinity double prime over k minus 2i mu infinity prime plus v plus stuff over k. So if you just take the stuff which does not, the O of one stuff, it is this. Therefore, V of x is 2i mu infinity prime of x. So that establishes a connection between V and this. So this is minus 1 over pi k ddx of no, sorry, there's no pi here. There's no k. Okay, so the recipe for the inverse problem is you solve this linear integral equation. You give me r, I solve this linear integral equation, I get mu minus. Once I have mu minus, I can calculate this, and therefore I have V. You need assumptions all over the place. On what? Sure. Well, you cannot just make up assumptions. The difficulty is, why did it take so many decades to put this into a full proof? The difficulty is you want a class of potentials V at the beginning for which you get an R such that all this works. So you want to identify the class of V, then you want to identify the class of R and show there's a bijection from V to R. That's a lot of work. So easily more than, at least a semester's worth of a course. But that's not what this course is about.
In the case when we don't have zeros, do we have some extra equation?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, there's also finite sum. But again, usually people don't do it on this side, they do it on the Fourier side. Okay. So is this more or less clear how this goes, the 1D business? Questions? All right. Now, this was so much fun, let's do it again. So this is what now the seemingly simple observation that Rafi Kaufman had, which had tremendous implications in the whole business. So, let us go back to the basic equation, this one here. Mu plus minus mu minus is r e to the minus 2i kx mu minus. So let's define mu to equal mu plus if k is in the upper half plane, and mu minus if k is in the lower half. So now I'm defining the mu in the whole k-plane. What it does on the real axis, I want to leave ambiguous right now. So what Koifman, coming to this inverse scattering business for the first time, he said, well, this is just a d bar problem. Let's see, what is ddk bar? So recall, ddk bar is a half ddk r plus I ddk I. What's ddk bar of this as a distribution? Well, let's see, what do we expect? This function is analytic up here. So I expect it to ddk bar of this to be 0. Okay, to be 0 here. And now, it's a jump. As you come from the plus to the minus side. Right? They're two different functions. So I claim ddk bar is simply I over 2. Mu plus minus mu minus times delta function of ki. So I can claim that ddk bar of this, in the sense of distributions, is a measure supported on the real k-axis. And in fact, it's just, if you wish, Lebesgue measure times the jump. So how many people want to see me actually do this? Okay, fine. The students who count, meaning that they're registered, are asking for this. So we'll do this when in the next hour. So basically, he was saying if I give the reflection coefficient, I'm in fact giving d bar of this function. And if I have d bar of a function, and I know that the function goes to 1 for large k, I ought to be able to find the function. Well, yeah, maybe we should, why don't we do this calculation so that you, sorry, this is times delta. Let's do the calculation. So how do we differentiate with this as a distribution? You have to hit this against some test function. Let's call the test function psi. So psi is the infinity of compact support in the whole plane. And by definition, this is minus bdk bar psi mu applied to dk bar, right? That's the definition of the derivative in the sense of distributions. So this is equal to minus, well, mu is defined in two pieces. So one is the integral for ki positive that gives us mu plus. Right, so this is basically a function. This distribution mu is a function. It's just that it's two different functions in two different places. So what do I mean by the distribution mu applied to psi? I mean integral of mu times psi. Maybe I should have put that in first. So in that integral, what mu is on the real line doesn't matter. That's a set of measures zero in the plane. That integral splits into two integrals. One is the integral in the upper half plane, and the other is the integral in the lower half plane. Okay, what am I going to do now? Class? Yes, we integrate by parts. And since psi has compact support, I don't need to worry about infinity. And so this is going to be plus the integral psi d mu plus dk bar dkr dki. So this is u dv equals v du And then I have integral of VU on. So this is so really we should do it separately for DDKR and separately for DDKI. So for DDKR, I'm going to get that. Since psi is zero at plus and minus infinity. So this is since psi equals zero outside a compact set. All right. Then I'm going to have, with a half in front. Then I'm going to have 1/2 psi d mu dki with an I in front. Okay, so I'm still looking at the first integral. I did the ddkr integral by parts, then the ddki, but for the ddki, I also have uv on the boundary. So that's psi kr ki mu plus kr ki dkr with ki 0 and ki infinity. Okay, everybody happy with this? I'm doing the DDKI, right? So it's U dV equals U times V at zero and at infinity, the KI, minus VDU, which is this. Plus the other one. So here we have minus, plus 1/2, minus infinity to zero. Here, see below. So the first two integrals add up to the integral psi d bar mu plus in the upper half plane. Minus I over 2. Well, at infinity, it's 0, but at 0, it's something. Psi kr ki 0 mu plus kr 0 dkr. So think of mu plus and mu minus as continuous up to the real line. So each of them have a limit. And now for the lower half plane, I will have again plus psi d bar mu minus dkr dki. And now we have to watch the signs. So it's the same minus in front. Integral psi kr ki mu minus with ki from minus infinity to zero. Well, mu plus is analytic in the upper half plane. So this is zero. Mu minus is analytic in the lower half plane, so this is zero. And now I have I over 2 integral psi kr 0 mu plus kr 0 minus mu minus kr 0 dkr. So this is I over 2. Put back the double integral psi kr ki mu plus kr ki minus mu minus kr ki delta ki. I mean, sorry, that's... I mean, you can just take this to be the definition of mu plus kr minus mu minus times delta. Apply to psi. Okay? So that proves the claim that ddk bar of mu is I over 2 times the jump times delta on the real line, as expected. So if you've ever done the fact that the Heaviside function prime is delta, it's basically the same calculation. So the jump is only in ki, and that's why you get a delta of ki. Okay, we have a 10-minute break and then a shortened third hour. suppose we know d bar of a function, and we know what the function does at infinity. How do we find the function? Well, we go back to what I call the Cauchy-Green formula. Where mu of k, let's forget about the x dependence right now. So if mu is analytic, well, okay, let me add the other term. So d2k prime stands for the measure in the plane, dkr prime, dki prime. Maybe I'll write that now. dkr prime, dki prime. So as I've mentioned before, if mu is analytic, this disappears. And you just have the Cauchy integral formula. Now, if mu goes to 1 at the rate of 1 over k, things that go like 1 over k make this disappear. Right, because this has basically an r in it. It's on the integral of a circle of radius r, and this is a 1 over r. And so what you get, you will let r go to infinity. So this gives us a 1, and then 1 over 1 plus. Maybe I should write this as a double integral over C d mu dk bar. I said suppose. I mean, that's what we've had all the time. No, it's a big O. This is not new. This is what we had all the time. Oh. Let's see. Exercise for the interested reader. So okay, now let's substitute what we know. We know d mu dk bar, or at least we have an expression for it. So we get r of k prime e to the 2i k prime x, actually minus mu minus x k prime. And we have a delta function in ki prime, so this becomes a real integral. Dkr prime over k minus kr prime. Okay, so you have to be careful. This is certainly the case when k is in the upper or the lower half plane. Okay, now suppose we want to approach the real k. So this is an expression for mu, the function equal to mu plus on top and mu minus on the bottom, in terms of the jump. Now, if we want to find mu minus, for k real, that means we want to take, then you have to start being more careful. This is the limit as ki goes up to 0. Of this integral. So that's 1 plus I over 2 pi. So this would be kr minus I0 minus kr prime. RKR prime e to the minus 2i KR prime x mu minus x KR prime dKR prime. So let's compare this with the integral equation we had before using projections. And amazingly, all my signs are correct and everything's fine. Yeah. Here it should have been a minus because that's what the jump is. I should be careful when I say all my signs are correct. It's true with probability zero. All right. So at first sight, it sounds like this observation of Koifman's is not much help. Right? It doesn't give us anything new. And in fact, it gets into some tricky business because D bar is singular. It gets into some tricky business about, you know, when is this Cauchy-Green formula true, in what sense is it true, let's take limits, and so forth. So that in fact, when Beals and Koifman wrote their first 1D paper, they didn't even mention D-bar. They went back to the Riemann-Hilbert business. So the Riemann-Hilbert problem is I give you a sectionally holomorphic function like this one and some information about the jump across different regions and some information at infinity, recover the function. There's a whole theory of such problems. When they are matrix valued or when the jumps are multiplicative, it's tricky business, but it's well understood. They then also wrote in some lecture, like Gulay-Schwarz lectures, they presented this D-bar formalism. So why is this important and very fruitful observation? Well, so this remark of Koifman's first of all shows that the scattering data R. Now, initially, the scattering data physically has to do with what happens with the solutions far away. But this formula shows you the scattering data measures the departure of mu from analyticity. So that means in problems where physically it may not make sense to talk about scattering data, you can try to define functions and define the scattering data by looking at D bar in this new parameter K. So this is, for instance, what I did with Ablowitz on the heat equation. If you tell physicists we're doing inverse scattering and inverse scattering on the heat equation, they'll scream bloody murder. Because a lot of the physical intuition about what should happen in scattering, I mean, it's just not right for the heat equation. Yes, you can play this game and you can find families of solutions and calculate DDK bar of them. So this opens up a whole new horizon. And it opens up another new horizon, which is we are no longer limited to solutions which are sectionally analytic in K. So all the inverse scattering business up to that point was in some way or another cast as a Riemann-Hilbert problem. So to have that, you first have to construct solutions which are analytic in K in some regions, right, together with calculating their jump. So whenever you'd have a new problem, people would try to calculate analytic solutions. In fact, one of my very first jobs in this business was to convince Manakov, who was one of the names in the inverse scattering business. He was sure that for KP2, for the people who know what that is. He could construct sectionally analytic functions, and he had a very complicated construction. And so we argued, and then I spent something like 3 weeks trying to disprove his, I mean, show that his construction was faulty. So I mean, it's much harder to disprove things sometimes than to prove. So again, this is just to point out to you where things were before. People couldn't do anything unless they were able to construct solutions which had some sectional analyticity. Now I don't need this anymore. As long as we can calculate DDK bar. So sectional analytic means that DDK bar is supported on some curves, right? And it's zero elsewhere. Well, who cares? If I just put in here, it doesn't have to be a delta function, right? As long as I know what this is, I can do the same thing. And that will be the case in our problem. In this problem, in general, mu will not be analytic in K. D mu dk bar might be, in general, spread throughout the whole complex plane. It's not supported on a line, as in the case of 1D Schrödinger. But with that kind of insight, that will allow us to go. All right. So the motivation is therefore that we will want to look at d mu dk bar for our solution. And somehow intuitively, it would be nice if we could look at what our solution does far away in X to see what would be a natural analog of the reflection coefficient. Okay. So those were my two reasons for presenting the 1D business. So if you without this, right, I could have said, well, here's some nice solutions, let's calculate DDK bar of them. Why? Okay. So now, asymptotics. So I'm still doing motivation and I'm still working formally. Asymptotics of mu. So back to 2D. We're done with the 1D story. Asymptotics of mu for large X, not large K, but large X right now. So I'm going to get them from the integral equation for mu. So first of all, asymptotics of D bar inverse F, so D bar inverse F of Z is is, let me remind you, the Cauchy integral convolution by 1 over z. And far away for large z, that behaves like 1 over z times the integral. Now note that for that to make sense, the integral of f has to make sense. We won't worry too much about this right now. So what about, I want to get up to mk, d plus ik inverse f equals, what was it? It was e minus k d inverse ekf, where ekz is just the function e to the I z k plus z bar k bar. So this is going to be e minus k in front, can't do much about that. D inverse will give me a 1 over pi z bar times the integral of that, eky f of y dy. So I want to give this a name. It's going to occur. I want to call it Fourier transform f at k. So let's calculate what that is. So integral eky fy dy. So this y is in, this is, the integrals are in 2D, right? So this is equal to e to the I real part of k y1 plus I y2 f of y1 y2 dy1 dy2. So forgive the abuse of notation. So the abuse is identifying points in R2 with complex numbers. Why do I say real part? Well, because it's this plus complex conjugate. So it's actually two times the real part. And the real part is k real times y1 minus k imaginary times y2. So this is what we call script f Fourier f of at k. So now you can see exactly what it is. It's the Fourier transform of f In the first spot, I have minus 2kr. And in the second spot, I have 2ki. Right, where f hat xi as usual. y1 xi1 plus y2 xi2. So this is the Fourier transform, it's just not exactly at k, so that's why I write it on the screen. So this is for z going to infinity, plus lower order. So here comes a little bit of fun. So note that I'm giving you the large x asymptotics of the Fadeev-Greens function without writing down the Fadeev, the integral formula for the Fadeev-Greens. I'm just using my formula for this, for the operator. So here comes the fun now. What about d plus ik inverse of d, d bar inverse of f? What's the large k, large x asymptotics? So large x asymptotics. Well, according to this, this is E minus K over pi Z bar fancy Fourier of D, D bar inverse F. So that looks messy. However, right, so in some sense it doesn't have an asymptotic, so the, I mean e to the kz times this is just a clean d inverse, so it'll have a series in k. Or it means that this minus that maybe times z will be in LP tilde. So then the E minus K doesn't matter. Right? I mean, formally or informally, if this is O of 1 over Z, because O takes absolute values and this is absolute 1. So, what is d d bar inverse F Fourier transform? Well, this is a multiplier. And we're multiplying by the symbol for D, which is I over 2 C1 minus I C2. Remember, D is 1 half DX1 minus I DX2. Symbol for DX1 is I C1, and so forth, over symbol for D bar, half. So it's equal to C1 minus IXC2 over C1 plus IXC2 F half. So when we talked about that operator, we saw it's a multiplier on the Fourier transform side. This is absolute value 1, so it's bounded on L2, and in fact it's bounded on LP. Well, back to here, this is equal to Fourier. Okay, so instead of K1, I'm supposed C1, I'm supposed to put minus 2KR. Divided by two minus 2KR plus IKI times FFK. So that's equal to multiply top and bottom by minus 1, and you'll get K over K bar. I just love this. I don't know why, but I think very cute. So, MK of F, which is minus 1 over 4 IK D bar inverse F minus D plus IK inverse D bar inverse F . How does this behave for large Z? Well, this is as Z goes to infinity. Well, first we've got ourselves a D bar inverse. So I look at this 4 pi I kz times the integral of f. And then we have plus 1 over 4 pi I K Z bar E minus K times k over k bar. FFK. So FFK is integral EKF. So this is minus 1 over 4 pi I z KZ. Integral f plus e minus k 4 pi I k bar z bar integral e k f. Now we will not need this in the the proof of our inverse theorem. I'm still just using it for motivation to introduce the scattering transform. So from mu equals 1 minus mk q mu, we thus get mu xk goes like 1 plus 1 over 4 pi I kz integral q mu, let's call it y. Right, so that's my f now. My little f is q mu. And then minus e minus k over 4 pi I k bar z bar integral EK Q mu. Plus lower order. So in some sense, this is the analog of A, and this is the analog of B. So this, so there's no scattering in the physical sense going on. Nonetheless, for our solutions carefully constructed before, we now understand roughly what they look like at infinity. At least if Q is nice. And interestingly, this, which is a perfectly nice transform of mu, will not be needed in our inversion. So this motivates us to define the scattering transform of Q as P of K equals the integral EKY Q mu. I remind you, we are in 2D. So note, tau is sometimes useful, but won't be needed. So this was one of the main advertisements at the beginning. I will define a nonlinear Fourier transform of Q. This is it. You give me a Q in LP. Which comes from a conductivity equation so that there's no poles, no singularities in K. You construct mu, and you define T to be basically the Fourier transform of Q mu. So notice that mu starts out as 1. So this is equal to Fourier transform of Q. Plus, I'll write down O of Q squared. I'm rushing this because time is up. But the message I'm trying to get, right, mu is equal to 1 plus O of Q, whatever that means. Therefore, if you substitute here, you get T is Fourier transform of Q plus O of Q squared. So that the linearization of T in Q, the linear part, is the Fourier transform. That's what allows me to call it a nonlinear Fourier transform of Q. So the way the proof of the theorem will proceed is we'll now use D bar to get from T back to Q. And gamma in the spirit of what I motivated in 1D. And then we'll calculate T from the Dirichlet to Neumann map. So therefore, if you give me the Dirichlet to Neumann map, we'll find T. And once we have T, we can do this D bar business and get back Q. Note that the Dirichlet to Neumann map also determines the tau. I mean, we haven't proved that, but the proof that it determines T also shows it determines tau. Thank you, and see you in a week.